on a giant boat, and when I got seasick, he said, "Come on, let's throw up." And he took me by the hand, then grabbed my ankles and turned me upside down over the water to vomit, shouting names of foods that he thought would make me sick. Eggs, rotten hamburger meat, sardines, hogshead cheese. I ate hogshead cheese once for $1 and to impress him. I drifted out of my body over the water. It gave me an aerial view of the scene, the fast-moving boat, the crashing waves, the gorgeous water spewing into my face. It was both exhilarating and terrifying, and when I landed back on my feet, everyone clapped. This was the year Jaws came out, and even if you hadn't seen the movie, you knew the theme song. Kids would imitate it. Bum, 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 pointing their elbows up out of the water like a shark's fin, and then ducking to swim under to pinch you. The older kids would run from the water and scream, "Shark, shark," pointing at the ocean and scaring the crap out of us. It was the summer I learned to put meat tenderizer on jellyfish stings when a lifeguard rescued me. The summer when everybody was kung fu fighting. When I was 5, my dad was shooting hoops in the driveway, and I walked out of the house with a cigarette. "What are you doing?" he said. "I'm smoking," I replied. "Smoking's bad for you," he said. "Well, you do it," I said. I'll never forget how animated he was when he took his cigarette pack out of his pocket, walked to the garbage, and exclaimed, "No, I don't," and threw them away. He made a big show of it, and I knew this was a performance, that he'd get the cigarettes out of the garbage once I went back inside. When Dad went to work, my brother and I had a routine where we'd chase him out the door saying, "Daddy, where are you going?" And he'd say, "Crazy, you want to go?" And we'd all do a crazy dance and be silly for him. He liked to ask, "What if you never got any taller? What if you just stayed the same size?" His face held a ponderous and sincere question, deadpan. He called us the yard apes because we were always climbing trees. When monkeys would come on the television, he'd say, "Missy, Tophie, you're on TV," and we'd act like monkeys climbing on him, and he'd throw us high into the air. My dad told us so many stories, and I wasn't sure if they were true or not, and it didn't matter then. He told us that there was a tiny repairman, Mr. Manny, who worked inside the TV. When we were 5 or 6, my father drove me to his house. A woman answered the door, and I asked for Mr. Manny. She said she was his wife and that he wasn't available, that he was asleep inside his matchbox. I was too shy and stunned to ask anything else, like how could she be married to a man who was so small? And did he really ride on record player needles for fun? And did he fix telephones? Did he know the little people that lived in the bookshelves on Captain Kangaroo? How did he make himself so small that he could go inside the TV? Because I really wanted to go there. Another of my dad's favorite stories was about how we were made. "Well, God made you out of clay," he'd say. And then he'd start to mime this. He'd roll the invisible clay between his palms and show us an invisible tiny ball between his index finger and thumb. "God rolled a piece of clay in his hands to make a ball for your head." I was mesmerized since he was a good mime. "Then for your legs, he'd rub his palms together smoothly and gently." He took more clay. "And the same for your arms and fingers." He placed the invisible parts on a surface for us to see. He could really rearrange reality. Another thing he could do was make other people's warts go away by rubbing them. He said it came from his Indian blood. In kindergarten, the teacher asked us to tell the class what our fathers did for a living. My brother raised his hand and said, "My dad was an Indian 100 years ago. This wasn't true. He was a salesman at the Vantro Cadillac dealership owned by his uncle, Granny's brother, Truman Van Veckhoven, who went by Van, and his friend Toby Trowbridge. Van was a self-made man who never finished high school. He played golf and ate at the country club. He shouted, "Ketchup!" when there wasn't any on the table and was so charming that everyone laughed. He said things like, "Life is a pier and you walk down it like you own it." He invented his life and then died of a heart attack on the golf course after he told a joke. He died laughing. I don't know a better exit. I had another uncle who died in a bathtub after a heart attack with a prostitute before I was born. Bravo. Bravo to both of them. My dad's father figures were his Uncle Van William Faulkner, Bob Dylan, Catholic priests, and God the Father, and Atticus Finch from To Kill a Mockingbird. Who didn't want Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch for her father? We had a nightly prayer, my brother and I, that started with, I love you, Jesus. Help me be better tomorrow. And then asked God to bless our family. We ended the prayer by saying, and help Father handle his job. When I was old enough to understand the real situation, my parents told me that we were praying for Father Rogers. The whole time I thought Dad couldn't handle his job, but Father Rogers was a priest in the parish and he was having trouble getting through the sermon sober. He was cool and we all loved him. I had some sweet nuns as teachers, but I had a mean kindergarten teacher named Mrs. Sweet. She once grabbed my brother by the arm and pointed a finger in his face for playing tackle instead of touch football. I marched over to her and pointed my finger in her face and said, no one talks to my brother that way, and got sent to the principal's office. Sister Mary Louise called my mom, who was so touched that she cried. In first grade, Sister Mercedes was our teacher, and she was truly sweet. On Fridays, we would line up from shortest to tallest and walk down the hallway on our way to Mass. The girls would reach into the cabinets for bobby pins and round black doily veils to pin to the top of our heads. We'd walk very slowly, heel toe, heel toe, heel toe, focusing on our hands, tight in prayer, and standing up straight as tall as we could make ourselves. I'd occupy this time by feeling guilty that Jesus was nailed on the cross and there was nothing I could do about it. The spooky organ music could be heard while we made our way through the cafeteria, grades 2 through 6 lined up behind us. Ash Wednesday was the most intense and ceremonious. Remember, man, that you are dust, and unto dust you shall return, the priest droned as he made a cross out of ash with his thumb on each of our foreheads. It was cool to keep the ash on your head as long as possible. And the mood was extra somber and intense on that day. That was the look. Classes were lax, and we had more playtime to be morbid. We're all going to die anyway. It's fun on a playground. Jesus was my first crush. How could he not have been? In those days, I tried to see him. As it got dark, I sit in my bedroom, on the floor, and against my bed, far enough from the window to see a reflection in the glass if he should appear. I'd watch the lamp in the window's reflection get brighter or more clear as the sun went down. I never saw Jesus, and I was sad about that. My dad comes up to New York to Sloan Kettering for his prostate cancer that he's had for more than 20 years from the Agent Orange in Vietnam. He flies up here in a private plane owned by an industrial chicken farm that flies patients out of goodwill and because they can afford to. Last time he was here, he told me his doctor called him a drama king, and I told him I think she meant drama queen. He persuaded his neurologist to come to the hotel and have a drink with all of us, me, my mom, her brother Jimmy, and my Aunt Catherine, and even got the doctor to remove the bow tie he was wearing because it was too uptight. Like a king, he wanted to arrange a marriage. And like a queen, I wasn't having it. Part 2. As the World Turns. Thirteen. Dazed. Sweet emotion. I was a fan of Rick Linklater's before we shot Dazed and Confused. We all called it Dazed. He made the movie Slacker, the seminal Generation X movie, and no one had seen characters like these in movies before. Nothing seemed to happen in the film because there wasn't a real plot. But if you were the black sheep, or the white sheep, or the weird cousin in your family who wasn't conforming to what everyone else was doing, but instead philosophizing about how weird everything was, then you could have been in Slacker. I got a call from my agent at the time, Brian Swordstrom, who said Rick was casting a movie he was directing about kids in high school in 1976. I was excited about it. The 90s had a 70s counterculture nostalgia, and I already had platforms and bell-bottoms of my own to wear. I was also really young, 24, and confident. Don Phillips was the casting director for Dazed, and he'd cast Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and he was a character. So much so that it was made into one in David Rabe's play Hurley Burley, which I ended up acting in years later. Eddie was his character's name, the one with the heart and coke problem. Donna's pretty special. They broke the mold when they made him. A good casting director is like the vibrant aunt or uncle to a film, or maybe even more so, the godfather, since they're the ones with connections to the agents. If your agent and casting director have some vendetta between them, then you don't even get into the room with the Don. I belonged in the room and had the right attitude. I remember the 70s really well because I looked forward to growing up when I was little and still loved the music. We talked a lot about music in that first meeting. Rick said a lot of the budget was going toward getting the rights for songs like Bob Dylan's Hurricane and Aerosmith's Sweet Emotion. Almost everyone knows the title of the movie is taken from the Led Zeppelin song. I told him I wanted to play Darla, the main hazer, because I wanted to be a bad girl. I wasn't one in high school, but loved Rizzo and Grease, and that's what they said the Darla part was akin to. My Aunt Peggy had some hazing stories, which I told them about, like having to swallow oysters knotted together by dental floss, only to have them pulled out of her stomach by one of the seniors. There were the Farrah twins from back home, who keyed some cars of ex-boyfriends in high school, which I thought was crazy, and pitched the idea, I guess. None of us, or at least none that I can remember, were rich kids. We were all more likely to have grown up around Harleys and good music. So they flew me to Los Angeles for callbacks, and that's where I met Joey Lauren Adams, who played Simone, and Dina Martin, the blonde of the movie who could barely zip her jeans, who had lived around the corner from me in Chelsea, and Marissa Ribisi, who played Cynthia and liked to sew and make things. We all hung out. Anthony Rapp played Tony, who was best friends with Adam Goldberg's character, Mike Newhouse. Marissa would be their best gal pal, and she was already sporting a cute red fro. Nikki Catt played Clint, Adam's nemesis in the movie, and I'd meet his mom later that year. She had a parrot and was a free spirit living in California. After we were cast, Rick sent us all mixed tapes of the music he wanted in the movie. I still have it somewhere. I think it starts with Cherry Bomb. Day shot in Austin, and we all stayed in that hotel by the bridge next to the Four Seasons. I forget the name of the place, but now it's something else anyway. I was on As the World Turns at the time, fresh from dropping out of college after 3.5 years on probation, mainly for a bad attitude because I didn't like rehearsing scenes, preferring instead to wing it. I had a lazy attitude for things I didn't feel were important, like circus class. I didn't have the guts to be a real clown and already knew how to juggle. I skipped class to clown around and kept my probation letters in the freezer for some reason. An act of self-preservation, maybe. There were around 20 of us in that hotel in Austin, and for the first 2 weeks of rehearsals and cast bonding, I was hardly ever there because I was doing the soap. I'd gotten cast in World Turns on April Fool's the year before, so I flew back and forth several times. It made sense for the character anyway, since she was a bad girl with a rough upbringing, I decided. She made her friends do things they'd regret the next day, like drink too much and say something they wish they hadn't, or go to the drugstore and swap the hair dye in the boxes, or put X-Lax in a batch of brownies, or Nair, her dad's hairy back while he was passed out drunk. She was one of those my feelings are facts people, one of those drama queens. If she and her best friend Simone weren't on screen for the party, they were in the woods kicking it with the older crowd. Joey and I wrote a casual scene where we were squatting in the woods to relieve ourselves, but it was shot wrong. They were supposed to fake that our pants were down, but you could see that they weren't. I don't remember if there was a scene with one of the guys going in the woods, but we'd never seen a girl go in a movie, and of course, we had in real life. Joey and I were best friends for a while, and we both had strong father figures, which makes girls more like tomboys and less like girly girls. She lived in L.A. and liked to build things, like a platform for her bed and a swing that hung from the ceiling in her living room. The vibe was Topanga Canyon-like, and she'd helped a boyfriend of hers build a shack there, so Joey knew her way around a hardware store. Joey's character was the girlfriend of Pink, played by Jason London. She's a pretty blonde who says "fry like bacon" to the freshman girls as they shake on the ground. We were like sisters, and since neither of us had one, that was nice. We listened to Leonard Cohen with Rory Cochrane, who played Slater, and watched the bats come out from under the bridge at sunset. Chrissy Harnos, who played Kay, would join, as would anyone else who was around. The hotel was like a dorm, really. We went dancing down 6th Street on weekends and ate Tex-Mex breakfast early in the morning after we wrapped. Typically, the girls hung with the girls and the guys with the guys. They shot guns at the firing range, and we decorated our rooms with scarves from the thrift stores. Here's a bit of synchronicity. After Wiley Wiggins, who played Mitch, the younger brother whom Pink takes under his wing, finished working on Rick's animated film Waking Life, like 8 years after Dazed, he worked as a troubleshooter for Apple. Jason London had just gotten a new Mac. Wiley answered the phone. Hello, I'll be your helper. This is Wiley. And Jason goes into his software troubles, and Wiley's like, Jason, is this you? Jeremy's twin brother? Dazed and Confused Jason? And they're both like, what? It's all connected, man. Cheers. Come on and take a free ride. Yeah. There was an actor in the film you may have heard of named Matthew McConaughey. Well, we were a few weeks into production when I flew in and went straight to work from the airport for an all-night shoot. Jean Black was our makeup artist, and there were Polaroids of some of the actors taped to the makeup mirror. What can I say but wow. This Polaroid of Matthew was freaking great. Ted Nugent meets Daredevil Evel Knievel and just as gorgeous as Jesus Christ. We died. Jean had her arms in the air like she was the next contestant on The Price is Right, like a Baptist taken by the Holy Spirit. We screamed with laughter at how genius this whole look was. That guy, yes. I got made up as quickly as possible and went straight to set to meet him in person. I asked Rick if I could stand outside the pool hall for Wooderson's entrance into the party scene. The scene was set to Bob Dylan's Hurricane. I love that song. I listened to all his albums as a kid. My love for Bob Dylan's music was one of the best things my father gave me. We'd talk about the stories of those songs, and I'd sit on the floor close to the record player and listen to his albums repeatedly, holding and pressing those huge padded headphones to my ears, though they were too big for my head. Hurricane is about an African-American boxer named Reuben Hurricane Carter, wrongly accused and convicted of murder. It's almost 9 minutes long and a masterpiece. Oh, man, I'm such a fan of Bob Dylan. Well, I guess it's just something you have to grow up with. Rick's laid back. He's from Texas and lives in Austin. He's charming and nice, and he's a dude's dude, a sports guy and a dad, and the real deal as a filmmaker. So yeah, I ran to set and asked him if he could throw me into the scene, and he said yes. I introduced myself to McConaughey and explained Darla real quick, that she grew up with older brothers in a broken home and is tough but fun. We rolled soon after, and when he and his posse strolled in, he came into the joint and slapped my ass and said, hey, Darla. That's what guys did back then, and in those days it was a compliment. I called my agent right away and told him he had to sign this guy, that he was going to be a huge star, but he didn't listen. I see Brian every few years and mention McConaughey so we can share a rueful moment. Rapping Dazed was bittersweet, and the experience gave me the meaning of the word. It was the high school we felt we belonged in. When we weren't working, we watched the other actors, and everyone was just so good. I'm thinking now of Adam Goldberg and Nikki Catt during their fight scene, the shot of Jason London looking around when he was on the football field at the end, and the music that made it all what it was. Rick called the music another character in the movie, but it was the soul. In 2003, there was a 10-year reunion for Dazed in Austin, and around 20 of us from the cast were there. It was a trip, and a few thousand people showed up. Joey hit the mic with Fry Like Bacon, and I shouted Air Raid. McConaughey breezed on stage, and everyone flipped out. The screening was in a park, and people brought blankets to sit on and partied with the movie. Some even stood up to dance when a song came on. We all sat clumped together on the grass, and there was one scene of Mike and Tony and Cynthia getting out of their car that had a boom mic in the reflection of the windshield. I looked over at Rick, who noticed it as well, and ran over to him. He was laughing and said, I made a drive-in movie, like it had just occurred to him. The extreme close-up of the keg was especially funny as people got on their feet to cheer at it. Rick was in New York in early 2016 for a spiritual sequel to Dazed, called Everybody Wants Some. I was invited to the premiere by the publicist, and they put me down as one of the hosts. I walked the 20 minutes it took to get there, in the fast stride that the early spring gives you. I caught up with Rick for a few minutes and said hi to Ethan Hawke, who was there to introduce the movie. After posing for some pictures, Ethan said, you should come on stage with me, and I said something like I would start talking and then say too much. I walked over to the after party, which was in a small Mexican restaurant on the Lower East Side, with David Cross joining me, who's always been too cool for school. I met Maria Semple almost immediately when I got there. Rick's new movie, Where'd You Go, Bernadette, is based on her book. My agent had been pursuing the project, chasing it, tracking it, making sure I was on everyone's radar. I ordered a drink. I was eating the chicken quesadilla and nachos that were sitting on the bar. She asked me what I was working on, and I said, other career options, new media ideas, new forms, courage, positive attitude, gratitude. I told her I loved the script and how rare it was to read something where the characters feel like you and your friends. She was super nice and said I was on the list of actresses to play the nemesis of Bernadette. I was more ripe for the lead, I told her, but knew how the system worked. She mingled away after that, which was a defeat to my bad attempts at mingling. You can't be direct while mingling, because that's not what mingling is, and I've never been good at it. I got pulled over by the publicist to take a photograph with Rick in front of a mural of McConaughey airbrushed onto a brick wall. He was leaning against his car as Wooderson, and Rick and I leaned against the wall to join him there. After the shots, Rick asked what I was working on, which is the same as how are you in showbiz speak. I said, other career options, gratitude, courage. I felt like crying for so many different reasons, and sensed he caught a tinge of the particular pain that comes with love or nostalgia. He has nice, kind eyes. Oh, Parky, he said, I hope we get to work together again. During my walk home, I found Sweet Emotion on my iPhone and wished I still had my rollerblades. There's no better intro to a song. Where do those rollerblades go? Did they leave without me? We're cruising at the right altitude to take our seatbelts off. 14. Southern Gothic. When I was a baby, I'd calm myself down by rocking back and forth on my stomach for several minutes at a time. Years later, I'd take a Kundalini class and do that same thing, but for 10 minutes. It's called Bow Pose, and it keeps your energy flowing. Kundalini yoga is the one where they wear all white and sport turbans and get high on breathing. They reach this blissed out state by doing lots of breath of fire, where you hold one nostril closed with your ring finger and breathe four times, focusing on the out breath. And then to the other nostril, pushing your belly in sharp like a punch and forcing your breath out to the count of four. It's like alternating leg lifts with each of your nostrils, and it's not pretty. But rocking through bow pose as a baby helped me process what I'd been through, what with being born and all. Looking back at that time, it was preparation for when I'd be able to stand up to deliver my first performance. I'd worked myself up so much, crying and shaking, that I'd stiffen my body and clench my fists at my side like rigor mortis. These fits were simply entitled Rigors by my parents, and when company came over, I'd perform them. It was up to me how long they lasted, but everyone knew that when I'd bite my own arm, that the show was over. And then there would be applause. So that's when I started performing, age 2, going on 3. It's sad to think it was some of my best work. The whole family would join in on the show. Papa would take his teeth out, which brought the house down, and Nani over at Lover's Lane would get on the floor and do one of her tricks, like hike up her pencil skirt and pull her leg up to wrap her ankle around her head. She didn't know the show-stopping trick was the yoga pose called Ekapadasarasana, or if you have trouble pronouncing words that sound like a sneeze, you can call it foot-behind-the-head pose. I can do this one, too. Did you know that yoga is Sanskrit for look what I can do? That's my friend Jason's joke. Glenn, my grandfather, taught me how to whistle with my fingers. It's good for hailing a cab, and I think of him when I do. Nani could spit through her saliva glands. I don't know how she did this. I've tried and am bummed that I didn't get this gene, but she'd stick her tongue to the roof of her mouth, and then a muscle would somehow activate and spit would fly out, like a spray from a water gun. We begged her to do this trick all the time, but she wouldn't often oblige, because it wasn't very ladylike. When she did, she'd excuse herself afterward as we applauded and screamed. She'd come back into the living room while we were still clapping, like any professional actor returning for an encore. We call my Uncle Jimmy Uncle Eyeballs because he could flip the tops of his eyelids up and keep them there and still look at us. He'd also get his teeth cleaned by asking one of Nani's Yorkies to clean them. Benji, Teddy, lick my teeth, and they would stick their tongues in his mouth for a full-on session. He was also very gifted at making fart noises under his armpits, various kinds of noises. My brother inherited this gene, and when he does it, he'll call out things like French horn, or question mark, or silent but deadly. When Hee-Haw came on the television, the entire family knew we could upstage anyone on that show, were we ever called upon to do so. It was a tough house, and we felt good watching it all together, because we knew we had better material. My dad says that as a child, I reminded him of Stan Laurel, of Laurel and Hardy. He refers to a time when my brother and I were in the bathtub, and he heard a scream. When he came in, Chris had a bite mark in the middle of his back. When Dad asked if I'd bitten him, I said no, and stared deadpan at him, like Stan Laurel. I almost got to be in a movie about Laurel and Hardy, as wife to John C. Reilly's Oliver Hardy. John and I met in the anniversary party, and he knows all the words to Jesus Christ Superstar, as do I, and we rocked out in my room at the Chateau Marmont. Must die, this Jesus must die. I love that guy. Would have loved to have played his wife on screen, but I got lost in space and wasn't available. When I was 4, I left the bathtub completely naked to knock on the neighbor's door for a visit. I loved hanging around old people's homes and perching myself on their armchairs or sitting on their kitchen counters. That was my vibe. There was a single lady who lived next door and was pretty, with long dark hair and a tiny poodle named Jojo. When Jojo was sick, my neighbor would crunch up a white pill and put it in the center of an Oreo cookie to feed him. I thought that was cool, being a single woman with a poodle. I've had Gracie for 14 years. And as much as she would love an Oreo cookie, she doesn't get one. I'll give her the occasional Tic Tac, though. Mint. She likes mint. My first time on a real stage came when I was almost 8, at a camp called Strong River in Mississippi. The counselors picked me to come up with a show, or presentation, really. I made it something about Little Red Riding Hood, uncovering the case of Goldilocks and the Three Bears. Telly Savalas from the show Kojak was my muse, and I walked on stage with a red tablecloth wrapped around my head, and a Tootsie Pop sang, "Who Loves You, Baby?" That was Kojak's trademark, and when everyone laughed, I remember thinking, this isn't funny. I'm playing a detective. I maintained character and waited a few beats for the laughter to die down and then went on with my next line. I take the stage seriously when I was 9 and started ballet. It was expensive, and I was glad my dad could swing it. I couldn't tap dance on our wooden floors, but there was some tile in front of the fireplace on which I could shuffle off to Buffalo or shuffle ball change. It could be annoying for my parents, so it was best to wait until I was alone. I couldn't be bothered to count in order to learn the routine for the recital, so I was sure to be close to the wings to shuffle ball change my way off stage. I only really cared about the tumble routine to the Star Wars theme that year anyway. The following year, my teacher, Miss Linda, and her assistant held auditions for chorus dancers in the company's production of Coppelia. Miss Linda was both elegant and strict, and when I auditioned, I looked directly at them, which made them laugh. She said, "The audience is in the mirror behind us. You can't look directly at us." My mom was there too, standing to the side of the room when Miss Linda told her I had charisma. And when I asked what that was, Miss Linda said it was talent. I was relieved to be called something that was good since I was a devoted daydreamer and adults often interpreted this as meaning I was developmentally challenged. My parents had some doctor come over to look at my brother and me when we were 2, who said we were going to be retarded and to hold us back a year in school. My parents laughed their heads off when they repeated this because the doctor was quite the character and they thought he was out of his mind. I don't remember him at all, but my rigors made them wonder. Everyone knew I came out half-baked or undercooked and should have stayed in longer, so maybe there was something wrong with me. But everyone enjoyed the rigors and I enjoyed performing them, so there you have it. That doctor was a dork. I spaced out in grammar school, so much so that my dad went so far as to attach jingle bells to my notepad so I wouldn't forget to write down my homework. This embarrassed me, but so had my red cloth shoes at kindergarten graduation, which stood out from the suggested but not mandatory expensive white patent leather shoes that all the other girls were wearing. The red shoes were cuter because they had flowers on them, and since they were cloth, I could wear them again. My mother could make things beautiful. The night before the first grade, I slept in my uniform. Up until that point, I just wore my own clothes to school and was excited to wear the jumper, like it was a costume. In second grade, I wanted to lie on the vision test so I could get some eyeglasses as a prop. My parents started to think I might have a learning disability, so they got me tested at the college in Monroe. I colored with the ladies who ran the program, who said I was creative and there was nothing wrong with me. Miss Linda accepted me into the ballet company, which meant I could go on point by age 11. I danced Coppelia for the recital, putting on my own makeup and false eyelashes like Nani did, and like my mother did to me on that first day home from the hospital on the army base in Baltimore. I made the local paper at age 11 when a Turkish man named Tanju Tuzer came to teach a 3-week class. He was gorgeous and graceful and had body odor, which made him stand out even more in my mind as someone serious. We made the paper together. In the picture, I'm pointing in Tandu, and Tanju Tuzer is holding my hand, and the girls in the background look intense and focused and maybe jealous because he's singing me out to Miss Linda as having talent promise. We had to move the next year, though, because Dad got an offer from Uncle Van to have his own dealership. I got my first slip that year when I was 12, which made my mother cry. I wore it under a dress for our going-away party. I also wore sandals, which were a half size too big, but it was fine because I took them off to dance around in the backyard as the boys played football. At one point I said, well, I can do this, and Grand Jetayed through the game. We left Indian Mound Road and the house with the empty carpeted room off the dining room area. John Lennon had died the previous December, and I'd been glad to be alone in that house to listen to his song Woman, which played repeatedly on the radio. I cried without any knowledge of what a woman was, but I'd seen pictures of Yoko Ono, and she was almost an adjective in my mind for someone who was different. Blondie's song, Rapture. I said, don't stop, to punk rock. We left Monroe in a packed station wagon, as two dogs humped in our neighbor Mama's yard. I was holding our new poodle, BB, and Dad said, cover BB's eyes, don't look at that. And we laughed as we cried. I tried to cover her eyes. We were moving to Laurel, Mississippi. A quaint, old, southern town, much smaller than Monroe, that still had the provincial gone-with-the-windness of the old South niceties where, don't you look cute, sounded to me like that was all that was expected. It was a town where you had to belong to a church, and being Catholic was weird to other Christians because we worshipped Mary, drank wine that we called the blood of Jesus, and also ate his body in the form of a wafer cracker. People in the town took their religion so seriously that there was an ongoing, my church is better than your church drama. There were 41 Baptist churches, and the two most popular ones, Highland and First Baptist, had competing bumper stickers. I found it at Highland. And touche, I never lost it at First Baptist. Found what? Lost what, exactly? In seventh grade, there was a rumor that the magnetic strip on the back of credit cards was a code written by the devil. The girl that told us this was freaked out and pleaded with us to tell our parents not to use credit cards because they would go to hell. She had no idea then that she was a burgeoning anti-capitalist. Now she was just a homewrecker. My dad took my brother to a KKK meeting when we moved to Laurel because he wanted to show Chris how crazy it was. I had wanted to see the idiots, as my father called them, but I was a girl and he didn't want me there. I was a ballerina at this point and this town was breaking my vibe. One of the churches in town had a Christmas pageant, and God flew in a carpenter actor from Florida to play Jesus. The minister's wife ran away with him after the show, so she got finally saved. She found it and was no longer lost. I think as the story goes, they lived happily ever after in the hair salon they shared together in Florida. That summer, the summer we moved, Tanju Tuzer suggested I apply for a 6-week summer ballet class with the University of North Carolina School of the Arts Ballet Company. I got in and had the time of my life the following summer. I auditioned to enroll as a full-time student but didn't make the cut. My dad knew I'd be devastated, so he called the dean to ask him what he should tell me, and he said, tell her she's an actress. I think the dean was called Dean Irby, and he said I'd almost gotten in based on my personality. When Dad told me this, I was shy about these ambitions because I didn't want to upstage my family, and being a professional actress, I invariably would. My dad was the star of the show, always. He'd do things like place a fart machine under the seats at check-in at the airport, and we'd wait for reactions when it sounded off. His performances were nonstop. He'd introduce himself afterwards and make small talk with strangers. Sometimes they laughed, and sometimes they didn't. I'd go back to Laurel, where I starred in Little House on the Prairie in my living room opposite the television set. I'd seen many episodes, and when Melissa Gilbert cried, I cried along with her. I could almost guess the dialogue. My mom and I loved to watch Mommy Dearest together. We got the camp of it and would imitate it for fun. Clean up this mess, Christina. That's just like my mother, she'd say, and we'd laugh. I liked when my parents would go out on a date so I could be alone and put on this black lace turn-of-the-century dress that I'd gotten in a secondhand store in New Orleans. It was like something Madame Defarge from A Tale of Two Cities would wear, the knitting old crone in a rocker who knew all the details of the tragedy. Or Miss Havisham from Great Expectations, another great part. The dress had holes in it and smelled like cat urine. I washed it in my bathroom sink, which made the water turn brown, and the smell never left, but I wore it anyway and played depressing music on my record player and cried. That was my idea of fun. I put ice in the sink to wash my face and then get into bed to read or write a letter or watch Pee-wee's Playhouse and a recorded VHS tape in the TV room. I have no idea what happened to that dress. I opened the door of a moving car once when I was around 8. I was in the car with my dad. Sitting in the back was my brother and his friend. We were just going around the corner from our house, so my dad wasn't driving that fast. I simply opened the door, swung my feet out of the car, and held on to the handle, like I was water skiing on the pavement. I don't remember why I did it, but I remember thinking I could put a stop to whatever the stress or noise was if I just opened the door and stepped out. It didn't last longer than a few seconds, and Dad slowed the car down enough for me to coast. He was laughing when I got back in. Why did you do that? I shrugged and looked down at the burned rubber on my sneakers. The tracks in the bottom of my shoes had worn down, and I felt the loss of them with my fingers. The smoothness and heat of them made me smile. And you hip-hop, and you don't stop. I stood under a tree in the rain and thought about lightning striking me and fantasized about being kidnapped. Maybe it was just me, or a child of the 70s kind of thing, or the simple kid drama of wanting to be special. Patty Hearst was kidnapped, and I was too young to be afraid or to see it as something real. To me, she was a woman in a car, being whisked away. It must have resonated with that early Catholicism and her being a fabulous martyr cast out by her father and left alone to suffer in her outlaw state. She wore a beret. There was a pervert who had a kids' show. His name was Mr. Wonder of all things, and he molested kids. My parents rolled their eyes at his name while gritting their teeth in anger. And there was Mrs. Banks, some bad shit daycare woman who chased kids around with fly swatters to whack them with when they were just playing. She had some cult-like nap regimen where we'd drink red or purple Kool-Aid and go to our mats and nap, even if we weren't tired. My brother told my mom about it, and we didn't go back. I think we were 4 or something. It was the beginning, I guess, of not liking banks or being good with money. A few years later, Jim Jones had Kool-Aid, and people drank it and died. I had a crush on John McEnroe as a kid. When I saw him get so upset on the tennis court, it pulled my very heart. I wanted to make him laugh or bring him something that I'd made, like a rock with the word Jesus painted on it. I prayed for him. My cousin Samantha and I would get out a sleeve of Ritz crackers and play Mass, getting all serious and somber while staring at each other, a Ritz cracker held up with our fingers. Take this, all of you, and eat it. This is my body, which will be given up to you and to all men, so that sins may be forgiven. Do this. Pause. In memory of me. And then we'd rock out playing the Jesus Christ Superstar album and singing and acting our hearts out. My mind is clear now. At last, all too well, I can see where we all soon will be. When the locusts came and dried out on the trees, we'd unstick them to decorate our shirts and even our hair like crowns and jewelry. The roughness of their skeletons made it easier to stick to us. The legs were slimmer than a toothpick, a few strands thicker than a hair. We take the tails off fireflies and stick them to our fingers to make rings, marrying the fireflies. When it flooded, we played in the ditches. The boys rode bikes in the water and popped wheelies or up and down the mounds, not 10 feet above the bayou. And all this was 10 minutes from our house. I'd sit on the top of the mound to watch them ride, while I dug in the dirt to find the clay, a patch or swirl of smooth in the dirt. If the locusts came again, I would still put them in my hair and on my clothes and say to passers-by, "The end is nigh." 15. Sacrifice. I wouldn't give my right arm to work with Woody Allen, so I gave my right wrist. I broke it 3 weeks after being cast in Irrational Man. When the bone surgeon in the city came into the room, I lifted my arm up like an opera diva, saying, "I got a big break being cast in the new Woody Allen film." He didn't think it was funny because he knew what was ahead. He would numb my arm out of existence in order to attach miniature door hinge hardware with 7 tiny screws to the tiny bones inside my wrist. This was 2 weeks before the camera test, and the pain was so severe that I stayed up through the night chomping the maximum number of Percocets prescribed and begged him for morphine the next morning. I told him I felt he betrayed me by not preparing me for the pain, that he tricked me. I asked if he was sure he'd done it right because it felt like something was wrong. He ignored my pitch of a morphine patch. "I'm sure they have one right around the corner at Bigelow Pharmacy." I tried not to sound like I was begging, but it didn't help that I answered the phone with, "I'm a basket case of pain." "It was good we went in there," he said with a bedside manner. "The break was a lot more complicated than we initially thought. An x-ray doesn't show the individual cracking of the bones. A cast might not have set it properly. So it's good we performed the surgery." "Yeah, it's good we went in there," I said. I apologized for blaming him, and he told me to take a leave, along with the Percocets. We hung up, and I ran to the bathroom to throw up. The night before, my right arm had been dead, but had come alive in the sensory map of my brain and made a double of itself, where I'd feel my fingers caress my face, like babies do when they're sleepy and content. A soothing gesture that I've noticed my mother and I still make. I broke my wrist in the house upstate. I starred in a Pepsi commercial with Jimmy Fallon that paid enough to get the mortgage. It was an old farmhouse that had been a sheep farm during the Underground Railroad days, and it disappeared off the market but came back after the buyer wasn't able to sell his place in the Hamptons. I'd seen only 2 or 3 properties before it, none of which were right, and then I got a job I don't remember, and when I returned to my search, that's when I saw it. "I've seen this place before," I said when I walked in. My friend Jim had forwarded me the listing, saying it looked just like me, around 6 months before. It was Tatum O'Neill and John McEnroe's house, and I'd run into her over the years socially and ran into her again just days after signing the ownership contracts for the property. We ran smack into each other at a dosa place in Soho. We were shocked and both stumbled back and hugged, and when we parted, we were both crying. She had spent some sweet years up there with her family and was sad to let it go, but was happy I was the one who bought it since I'd made her family laugh with the Christopher Guest movies. I was crying because I was grateful and dreamed of a country house in nature. At the time I broke my wrist, the pipes had frozen and burst and flooded the first floor. It was one of those out-of-the-blue freezing nights, and I didn't have a Nest device yet to sync up the heat, but I have one now. The neighbor across the street, Wes, saw smoke coming out of the chimney and came to the rescue. He knew I wasn't home, that there was no one there. I don't know how the smoke was coming out of the chimney. I guess it was an electrical fire. I have no idea, but it signaled. He always helped me if I needed it, and he loved the house since it belonged to his great-grandfather. He found Gracie when she ran away a few times, once clawing her way through a window screen when she heard a gunshot during hunting season. My sweet little lamb. She's snoring now. So Wes brought a few of his contractor friends over to meet me. It was a true disaster, and I was in shock. I started to block out the things I'd miss, like my albums I'd had forever, now destroyed, especially the records that were probably impossible to find, like the Catholic folk parish band, the Damians. They were a band of five priests from New Orleans, and they were really cute. And their songs weren't spooky because they didn't use an organ. Their voices harmonized so well with one another. It was patriarchal, good dad, tree hugger music because they'd include nature in the songs. I know the Father loves me, for he told me in the rising sun. I know the Father will care for me, for he told me in the smile of a certain someone. There were holes in the house now, and a kitchen to be reconstructed, which broke my heart because I loved the one that was already there, hand-built by Bernard Spring Steele, a previous owner before Tatum O'Neill and John McEnroe's family. He'd made it all in my bedroom, which was then his wood shop, with wood from the lumber yard just down the road. He made doors, cabinets, shelving, even the curtain rod holders. His countertop would have to go, and the cabinets were ruined, but the structure at least would remain intact. I left, leaving it up to the gods, and magically thinking the producers of this had a vision and supported the director, and it would all work out. Contractors can be tricky, though, like actors. One simply bailed, but sent me a nice note saying, "I'm sure you're going to be angry with me." But he had another job to do. I was leaving for Vermont. I wasn't angry. I was inspired that a line of work could actually include getting paid for doing nothing and then apologizing with an email. I loved his bit, though, in the beginning, of the sweet Uncle Good Old Boy coming to the rescue. The other one had started hanging around but was unable to complete the simplest of tasks and was always complaining about other work that had caused him pain. He would say things like, "You have anything stronger than an Advil, like a Vicodin?" My friend noted that he went by three different aliases, which most likely meant shady business. At first, I thought he was just so adored by three groups of friends that they all gave him special nicknames, but when I thought more deeply about it, having three names was probably a good idea for someone who needed people who didn't exist to put the blame on. I painted the walls myself after the countertops ran. I was furious that I'd gotten screwed over, and my adrenaline was pumping as I flew around the kitchen with a roll of blue painter's tape on my arm like a bangle bracelet. I'd whip the tape off the roll with my left hand and swiftly tear off a piece with my teeth, like a fruit bat, and place the length of it to its edge on the wall, flying around like a maniac. I fell off the ladder while reaching for an edge. Thank God my friend Jim was there. We'd been close for more than 20 years and met at Georgetown, where my brother went to college and danced together at a place called the Tombs. And by dance, I mean silly dancing, dumb dancing. We really made each other laugh. Jim moved to New York in 2001, right after 9/11, thinking that life was too short not to fulfill that dream of living in a city he'd always wanted to live in. He had great luck finding an apartment right around the corner from me in Chelsea. They used to have this girlfriend known as Elsie, with whom I shared four sordid rooms in Chelsea. I loved his place. If you could have taken his ceiling off and looked at the apartment from above, it would have been a perfect square. It reminded me of those pink, compact, plastic homes I played with when I was little that you could shut and carry around like a suitcase. The layout was a perfect circle. Open the front door. The bathroom is directly in front of you. To the left is a living room. To the right is a bedroom. Walk through the bedroom and go left through the kitchen. Then you're back in the living room. My place was a railroad flat, which was falling apart. The bathroom had a big hole in the ceiling that rained down plaster every now and then. I covered it with a garbage bag and duct tape because it was better than dealing with the super, who I'm not sure I ever met. I probably did, but my instincts told me it was best to just deal with stuff myself. I put in a loft bed with Keen, a high school friend of Nadia's. She has a good dad story, too. Nadia Dijon is an actress, and she never knew her father, but grew up with older brothers who were baseball fans. They were all latchkey kids in the West Village, and her brothers would pick her up from school, and she'd do her homework on the train to Yankee Stadium, which she called her childhood living room. She had a poster of the pitcher Ron Guidry in her bedroom growing up, and when she was around 12, she wrote him fan letters and sent him birthday cards. At around 14, she got up the nerve to write to him, asking him to wait for her until she turned 18 so they could get married. He sent her a small black and white photo, which in her mind meant yes. There was a bio release soon after, and she saved up her babysitting money to buy it and flipped to the pictures immediately at Barnes & Noble. She was crushed and started screaming, "No, no!" when she saw the pictures of him married and with the baby. She was madly in love and devastated. Anyway, her friend Liz invited her to a benefit gala for Camp Say, a summer program that raises money for kids who stutter. And it was there she met Brandon Guidry, who was on the board. She mentioned that it was funny that he had the surname of the man she was supposed to marry. "That's my father," he said. "He's my password," she told him. "Your father's my password, and when I travel, I take a framed picture of him to put by my bed." "Well, now I know your password, and he's here." Brenda brought her over, and Ron called her darling when they met. She told him they were supposed to be married, and his wife laughed. Brenda became like another one of Nadia's surrogate siblings and invited her down to Lafayette, Louisiana for New Year's, where Mr. Ron would say, "Make yourself comfortable here. Eat what you want. There's food in the fridge, and make yourself at home." She'd be floating in the uncanny realness of the events that brought her to Ron's home. And when she was asleep in one of the huge guest rooms, it would only dawn on her after he knocked on her door in the morning saying, "You have a 30-minute warning to get ready for brunch," that it was all real. She'd hear his heavy footsteps walk down the plush carpet of the hall, away from her, and take that mystical moment to her heart. Nadia lived close to me in Chelsea in the West Village, in a building she called a witch's hat because of the pointed cone on top. I was living on the second floor with a fire escape railing outside my bedroom living room, not 20 feet off the ground. I could easily ask one of the guys in the McManus bar to boost me up if I'd locked myself out, which I'd done a few times. I was so close to the sidewalk that I'd wake up thinking I had guests in my apartment, but it would just be people talking on the bench at the beauty shop directly below. Every few years, a neighbor would play Red, Red Wine on her boombox repeatedly for hours. It wasn't a conventional home and felt more like a sleeve or a place that could be tiny in. A friend said my paint choices were tonally Easter egg, light blue and yellow walls, lavender trim, and a cream line for the molding. I hover around the idea of a conventional home, and I think that's why I fell. I knew my wrist was broken because it looked like an upside-down ankle and because it hurt. I was a brave and calm soldier, like Brody in Homeland, who came to mind immediately since I'd been binge-watching the show. "Jim, there's a Vicodin stash in the first aid kit in the downstairs bathroom," I said. "Get me one, and take one if you want." I squeezed and carried my wrist to my truck, yelling back at him, "My iPhone, my purse, and keys are on the table. Shut the doors so Gracie won't get out, and the windows." We both remained calm and alert, like I'd imagined people in a war zone to be. I sat in the passenger seat, and dissociation started to kick in like a drug. And then Jim told me that he wasn't comfortable driving because of his recent eye surgery. Jim has nystagmus, which is a vision condition causing the pupils to flutter involuntarily, affecting his vision. He was working at Google then, and I joined him there for lunch the day before he was to leave for surgery. We sat outside, and he grieved the old sight he would lose, the floating garbage bags in his peripheral vision that looked like fluffy bunnies, the fading degradation in color of the fuzz around objects. All that cozy haze could become sharpened and cruel. What could this new way of seeing stir up and bring back? He came over after the operation. We had both moved since our Chelsea days, but were neighbors again on Lower Fifth Avenue, under a 10-minute walk from each other. He'd called before he came and was groggy from the pain meds, but wanted to see me. When I opened the door, I saw that the area under his eyes was bruised to his cheekbones. The whites of his eyes were red with blood. We hugged, and he walked slowly through my door, as if landing on another planet. He said, "It looks so clean in here," and looked around the apartment. He gazed at me, his pupils no longer shaking or shimmering, and his shoulders no longer hunched with the strain it took to look so closely at things. "You're so pretty," he said, crying, wiping his tears with his shirt sleeve. He was trying to catch his breath. "It took me longer to walk here. I kept stopping at the newsstands to look at the papers." He was viscerally shaken by the newness of it all. The edges now distinct for him, and what I imagined to be a release of the unrealized burden he was born with. The day that Jim stood outside my truck, I was in the passenger seat and slumped over in teeth-chattering pain, taking his hands to touch my head, to console myself out of this, and making his hands my own, alternately squeezing my wrist. "Hold my head tight with both of your hands," I said. He did. "Now pet my head." He did that too. "Now hold my head with both your hands, please," which he did. I started talking about Homeland and evoking Brody to come rescue me. "Soldiers feel this pain, and it's so much worse. You're going to be okay, Pumpkin," he said. I said, "I'm not dying," and we laughed a little. I said, "Many, oh my God," swaying to rock myself. The minutes in pain go by so slowly and so fast at the same time, but according to the clock, we waited half an hour for the ambulance to arrive. They drove down the gravel driveway, which had needed repair for years now, and the paramedics got out of the ambulance unfolding the gurney and shot me up with morphine once I got inside, where the drive up the bumpy road had me bawling. But there was a new hero to hold on to, Indiana Jones. The ER team went through the protocol. "What is your name? What happened? How did you fall? What day is it?" They asked me the same questions again, minutes later, and I had to say it all over again. "What horseshit," I thought. I said, "I told you already. Ugh, I told you." Someone asked if I was still in pain, and I said, "Yes, look at my arm." And they stuck me with another shot of morphine. I asked for more morphine when they made their final stop to wheel me into the hospital because they were about to ask me anyway. The hospital, which struck me as sad, made me even sadder when I was told there was no bone specialist in the building. The doctor on call was animated. He liked that I was a celebrity. "I know who you are," he said, and I cried harder. How could he know who I am? The presumption of that. "I'm not sure if you have any movies coming up, but you have a serious break." "Yeah, I know." I started to really wail, like Julia Louis-Dreyfus in Seinfeld, and looked around for a laugh track. Then he said, "We can't do anything about it here." Hull for laughter, "except to remove that blue tape around your arm to try to get an x-ray." I knew what he was saying, that he was going to break my wrist back into place. "I know what you're going to do," I cried. "I wasn't born yesterday." He waited a beat and said, "Do you need more morphine?" "Of course I did. Yes." He gave a nod to the nurse, and I reached out my good arm and we high-fived. Jim was there for that show and would squeeze my foot or shin softly and smile in that way that's reserved for hospitals with queasy love. He was there for the bigger show, too, when they pulled that blue tape roll off my arm to reset my wrist and I screamed bloody murder. He was there for the taxi ride to the bone specialist further into town, a visit I don't remember at all because it was a blackout. The stage was dark and no one was home. I like to think the bone specialist was Quincy from the 70s TV show Quincy M.E., played by Jack Klugman. When I came to and regained consciousness for a minute, Jim and I were sharing a taxi with a motley crew of teenage boys. Not a lot of cabs in the country. And they were getting their Saturday night party on in the afternoon, laughing and bobbing to the loud bass of rap music, their arms pumping to the beat, not even aware we were there. I was holding my cast arm at the elbow, like kids who know the answer do in class, but I was a mess. We scampered out of the taxi, feeling like invisible teenage losers, and we were glad we weren't made fun of or beaten up. Sitting on the curb waiting for our friend Mindy to pick us up, I called Lowe's to check in on some twin bed frames for the house I barely owned and that was sucking me dry financially. But since I had the Partridge Family fantasy, I wanted very much to keep it alive. It would have to be rented to help pay the mortgage. I nodded out on Jim,